This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. David Graeber's latest book has generated quite a stir. Debt, the First 5,000 Years, has influenced thinkers and activists around the world, partly because of the way it upsets conventional wisdom about how long systems of credit and debt have been around, and partly because it sets forth a number of uncomfortable and provocative facts about the origins of markets, the advent of money, debt, and commodities, and the development of our basic concepts of freedom and private property. On the occasion of the recent release of Debt, the First 5,000 Years in paperback, I recorded an extended interview with David Graeber by phone from New York City. Graeber is an anthropologist and activist based at the University of London. He's also one of the original organizers of Occupy Wall Street. Now, he's done numerous interviews about the book, and I wanted to do something a bit different. So Graeber and I agreed to focus on a single chapter in Debt, a chapter that consists of an extended essay with the title Honor and Degradation, or On the Foundations of Contemporary Civilization. I began by asking Graeber what he was trying to accomplish in and with this chapter.
I think I was trying to tie together a number of different things. The idea of honoring a debt, the idea that one's personal honor becomes entangled in one's ability to pay debts, seems to be the strongest force which keeps in place, you know, what I call the ideology of debt, the way that people feel that paying financial promises seems to be a greater moral responsibility than any other promises, and that if you have to make a choice between them, it's only natural you're going to choose the ones measured in money, which is strange and also socially terribly destructive. I mean, it's one of the things I really wrote the book to get at. So the whole question of honor kept coming up over and over again, and it related very deeply to some of the other questions I was asking, like, you know, where does money really come from? The conversion of what I call social currencies to commercial currencies, of money starting as a way of measuring relations between people and turning into something that's exactly the opposite. So it seemed to be an issue that brought everything together.
And you relate honor to the institution of slavery frequently in this chapter, and I'd like to begin with the story of Alauda Equiano. So he was sold to British slavers in the mid-18th century. He was brought to a Virginia plantation, and he was later allowed to purchase his freedom. He wrote an autobiography, the interesting narrative of the life of Alauda Equiano, or Gustavus Vasa the African. That was published in 1789. What interests you about Equiano's story in the sense of what it tells us about honor and how it operates?
The thing that fascinated me, if you read the book, he's this, clearly this extraordinary person. He's incredibly eloquent. He's incredibly talented. He's incredibly energetic and obviously quite brilliant, trapped in the worst conceivable situation. And the thing that fascinated me was that despite his utter awareness of the brutality and injustice of everything around him, he did not come around to an anti-slavery position himself. You know, this is a person who had been kidnapped, sold into slavery, exploited in every possible way, lied to, tricked, abused. Yet, for most of his life, he didn't actually oppose the institution of slavery. He finally did come around and became one of the very first of the abolitionist, you know, sort of inspirational abolitionist speakers, but after religious conversion. And I was really curious as to how that could be. And the conclusion I came to is that the one thing that seemed most consistent in his personality was that he was a man of great honor. He was very honest. He was a person of incredible integrity. He always kept his promises. And what being a slave means, above all, is having your honor completely stripped away from you. So obviously, the one thing you want above all else is to have your dignity and your honor restored. But it can only be restored within the system that exists. If you reject the entire terms of the system, you can't get your honor back. So it's the ultimate trap. In order to, like, get back what has been unfairly stolen from you, you have to recognize the legitimacy of that entire economy, which is the basis of it having been stolen.
Why couldn't you recover your honor by becoming part of an effort to overturn the system and get rid of slavery altogether?
Well, eventually eventually he did, of course. But, you know, it was only when he converted to Methodism, actually, he found a community of people who were willing to support an entirely different system of values, that he could do that. But honor only exists in the eyes of other people. See, that's the trick. You need to have a community.
There's also honor from the situation, from the perspective of the master, right? And you write about what the enslaving of people has to do with the honor and the status of the slaveholder.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing. I mean, the expression I used actually goes back to a class I taught with a Turkish anarchist friend of mine named Ayça Çubukçu. And we were talking about John Holloway and his notion of dignity. And coming from part of the world I come from, I'm a little suspicious of this whole notion of honor and dignity as the basis of politics that can really be abused. And I thought, yes, I mean, I understand what she's saying, but I guess there's a difference between honor and dignity. When you say dignity, that's something everyone can have, but honor is not something everyone can have. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that best formulation is almost a mock Marxist formulation. You could say honor is surplus dignity. Honor is that extra dignity you have when you've taken away other people's dignity. It can only exist by having stripped away other people of their honor. And therefore, you only have it sort of on loan almost. It's something that you have to maintain all the time. It can only exist in the possibility of you too being completely dishonored and losing it.
What you're suggesting is that honor has a lot to do with violence to the degree that, you know, you only have someone maybe under your power if some kind of overt or threatened violence is at play.
Precisely, which is why people who are very violent and live in worlds of violence, whether they're gunfighters or feudal knights or gangsters, are obsessed with their honor and respect. Anything that might seem like a disrespect has to be met with violence. And that's true whether you're talking with police or gangsters or anybody else who lives in that world surrounded by violence and the possibility of violence, soldiers as well. Indignity must be met by violence or else it's a mortal wound.
It's interesting because when I first began reading this chapter in your book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years, I thought in some ways you would counterpose honor to later forms of debt and argue that there was something honorable about honor. Is it your sense that in describing what honor really is or what really constituted honor, the naked brutality of it comes to the fore? Was that partly your intention?
I think so. Well, it grew on me. What I was trying to understand in the whole book is how debt becomes the metaphor for all morality. And it's clearly violence has much to do with this. If you look at the phenomena historically, my basic formulation I laid out was that a debt is just a promise, but it's a very particular type of promise. It's a promise that could be said to be corrupted by a combination of mathematics and violence. And generally speaking, when mathematics and violence come together, bad things are likely to occur. But one of the things that really did surprise me when I started researching this is just how explicit all of this stuff is, if you look in the right places. That's why I became fascinated with the Irish honor codes, because one of the arguments of the book is that money shifts gradually from being a measure of a way of rearranging social relations to being something you can use to buy potatoes and tools. But often when you do have what I call social currency, it's all spelled out. So in the Irish, these early medieval Irish codes, they just said, well, everybody has an honor price. And, you know, your honor price goes up if you have feudal serfs, you know, because if you have flunkies, they lose their honor and you get it. So, you know, if it normally insulting someone or killing them and thus insulting them even more, you know, because if you kill someone, you have to pay 5 cows for killing them and another 5 for insulting them by killing them. So everybody is worth about 5 cows, but if you have 25 flunkies, then you get all of their cows too, because you absorb their honor. So it's all laid out completely explicitly, and it's all about violence and the potential for violence and what to do about it.
And in medieval Ireland, there was something called slave girl money. So this brings explicitly into play this relationship between slaves and the payment of debts, correct?
Yeah, this is another, it actually kind of annoyed me, because you read this literature and they say, well, you know, there are 3 major denominations of currency. There's, you know, grain and simple things like that. And then you have gold and silver. And then, you know, highest denomination is slave girls. And it's like, okay, how'd that happen? And most of the accounts just poo-poo it. Well, there must have been a time they must have sold slaves a lot, but that was a long time ago, and this is basically just a unit of account now. But they just cast it away, you know, as if this is somehow unimportant. Well, why are they still using slave girls as a unit of account? And I had to dig around for a while before I found what I thought was a sort of smoking gun explanation of what happens, which is that the sort of highest level of violation of an honor code, if you kill a bishop or a priest or something like that, because remember, this is the very early Christian period we're talking about, and a lot of these, you get, you know, they have the highest honor price, and you have to pay their honor price. Well, the ultimate penalty is you have to turn over your sister, daughter, or some other woman in your family who, of course, you're supposed to be protecting and your honor is all about protecting, to be their laundry maid. So they spend the rest of their lives doing the dishes, basically. Mm. So it's not even necessarily about creating a harem. It's not even about sex. It's about degradation. It's about, like, you know, becoming a maid. So the ultimate stripping away of your honor is to, like, take one of the women you're supposed to be protecting, since you're assumed to be a man, and have her doing menial tasks for the people that you had the fight with, or that you insulted. And that's where it really came home, that these systems are all about the potential to strip away honor. So the ultimate denomination of money was a measure of degradation, your power to degrade someone else.
I see. David Graeber teaches anthropology at Goldsmiths College, University of London. We are talking about his book, Debt, The First 5,000 Years. It's recently out in paperback, published by Melville House. We have a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. My name is C.S. Song. Let's take a step back. You develop the concept of human economies, and I wonder if you could describe what you mean by that term and how it differs from a credit economy.
Sure. You know, sometimes I think of a quote from Marx, actually. Marx once pointed out that if you look at the ancient world or any society prior to our own, nobody ever wrote a book about what would be the conditions that would create the most wealth, despite the fact that, you know, now we have millions and millions of them come out every year. It's a major thing to talk about. It never occurred to people in most of human history to talk about that. They instead asked about what are the conditions that will create the best people. So, you know, wealth was, if anything, a subordinate factor. You know, you don't want to have too much wealth because then people become lazy, but you don't want to have too little because then they'll all be scrounging around. They won't be able to, like, commit to each other. So the question was always, what are the conditions that will make people the best citizens, the best friends, you know, the people you want to have around? So that idea of what is the ultimate value of an economy, what's an economy for, was essentially what I was getting at. In most societies, it's assumed that an economy is a way of keeping people alive, but it's also a way of creating, you know, kinds of people that you think there should be around. And that's what it's all ultimately about. Whereas nowadays, the very notion of the economy is something which didn't even exist 300 or 400 years ago. No one had ever heard of such a thing. Now it's the only thing we can talk about. And, you know, we've got to the point where the production of goods and services for sale is seen as the ultimate goal of all social life, to sort of prop this thing up. I always use the example of the AIDS crisis in Africa, because you have all these health ministers trained by the World Bank, you know, making statements. I've seen 3 different times this happened, saying, well, you know, we really need to pay more attention to the AIDS crisis, because if things go the way they're going, you know, half the population is going to be dead in 10 years, and that's going to have really bad effects on the economy.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason you can think of it, like, to complain if the people are all dead is that it'll affect the production of goods and services, rather than goods and services just being a way of producing people. So one of the questions I'm asking in a lot of my work is, like, you know, how we can get to the point where people can say things like that and not just be taken off in a straitjacket immediately. How did we get here? So the notion of the human economy starts with that sort of inspiration. A human economy is simply an economy where it is assumed that economies are about producing people, and the most important thing is rearranging relations between people. But more specifically, it has to do with money. You can tell the difference between a human economy and a commercial economy most readily by seeing what people do with money, if indeed there is money. What they used to call primitive money, whether you're talking about wampum or you're talking about bead money, shell money, feather money, woodpecker scalps. There's millions of examples of currencies that are used by stateless societies without elaborate markets. They're almost always used as ways of arranging marriages, consoling mourners, settling disputes. They're used to rearrange social relations rather than being used to actually buy things.
So you're saying that in many ancient societies, where money existed, it wasn't used to buy, to purchase things like food or tools. It was used for social purposes.
Exactly. And I give some detailed examples of that. The lele is a nice example in Africa. You know, they have this cloth that people are just constantly giving as gifts to one another. If you visit someone, you give them a piece of cloth. If you want to arrange something with somebody, you give, it's a sort of lubricant of social relations, and you need more of it if you want to settle up argument or, you know, something like that. And on top of that, they have other things, camwood, which are like high denomination for really important things. But you can't use this to get food. In fact, the ethnographer Mary Douglas found it was really hard at first, if she didn't have any social connections, to get basic things she needed, because, you know, she had lots of this stuff, but it could not be used to acquire, you know, basic necessities of life. Those would be given by people who loved you.
Now, when you say that at some point money was used to, you know, to buy things, are you saying that before, when it was used for social purposes, that it was primarily to settle matters of honor, just to get back to this concept of honor, or was just honor one of the factors that could come into play when money was exchanged?
Well, that's an important distinction. In most of the human economies I'm talking about, you don't have this sort of elaborate, touchy kind of feeling of honor that you get in, say, Mediterranean societies, in the Middle East, and places like Greece, Spain, Italy. You know, you have this classic rural honor society, as they call them. It's not like that. It's not like people are constantly touchy and feel they need to defend the honor of their womenfolk. That whole concept actually seems to arise as a counterpart to the market. But you do have a sense that social relations need to be sort of lubricated and propelled along. And you also do have a feeling that, you know, sometimes people are very upset. Often, if there's a feud, if there's a threat of violence, if there actually is violence, if somebody gets killed, in such cases, absolutely, you need to use this stuff to settle things. But the interesting thing about that is that, you know, if somebody kills your brother, and then they say, well, it's okay, I killed your brother, but here's like 25 cows, so it's the same thing, no one will accept that. Of course, that would make you even more mad and would almost certainly lead to a feud. You know, what you do is you say, here's 25 cows, or here's like 500 strings of beads, or, you know, whatever you're using as currency. And you say, obviously, this could not possibly be the equivalent of your brother, but this shows just how sorry we are.
David Graeber joins us on Against the Grain. His books include Revolutions in Reverse, Essays on Politics, Violence, Art, and Imagination, and Direct Action and Ethnography. We are talking about his latest book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years. All right, so David, at some point, as you say, and we all know, societies begin to use money not just for the purposes you've been talking about, but to buy things. So, and you write that the result of this transition from a human economy to a commercial economy was momentous in, among other things, moral terms. Before we get into a lot of specifics, can you give us an encapsulation of your argument here?
Okay. It's a complicated argument, but one thing you notice very quickly, if you look at material from the ancient Middle East, from ancient Greece, is that the moment you have that transition from what I call human economies, and I should emphasize, human economies are not necessarily more humane than our economies. They're just about human relations. I mean, they could be horrible. They could be great, too. There's a huge range of things they could be. But one thing that almost always happens when you get a conversion of one to the other is that there's a huge crisis over issues of, well, first of all, they discover the idea of premarital virginity, and it becomes very big. Prostitution becomes a huge issue. Slavery also becomes a big issue. And so patriarchal sexual morality, I mean, there's two meanings of the word patriarchy. If you want to talk about patriarchy just in the sense of male dominance, it goes back a very long way. But if you want to talk about patriarchy in the sense of the sort of classic image we have of patriarchs, like as in the Bible, who are sort of keeping the women shut up, veiled or hidden away, while they're the only ones allowed to go out in public, that kind of patriarchy. Well, that has very specific origins, and it seems to come about around this time. Because if you think about it, if you're in a human economy, a proper marriage is one which is money has changed hands, right? So, you know, if you have sex because money has changed hands, that means you're a good girl. Suddenly, the possibility of just cash transactions for commodities creates all sorts of problems with the relation of sex and money, which get worked out in a million different ways. But one thing that seems to happen in the Middle East, for example, and that's one of the great mysteries of early Sumerian and Mesopotamian history, is that when the curtain first goes up, when you have the first written records, things don't look that different than they do now in terms of gender equality. That is to say, you know, it's not like men and women are of equal social status. Men are clearly dominate the public sphere, but not entirely. You know, they have female rulers, they have female doctors, they have female bureaucrats. You know, maybe only a third of all these things are women, but, you know, women are doing everything. And over the next 1,000 years, that all stops. Suddenly they discover, you know, this whole obsession of premarital virginity, which hadn't existed before. They're locking people up. They're, like, taking women out of the public sphere. They're creating harems, which hadn't really existed, for kings. Where does all this come from? And a lot of it, oddly enough, has to do with debt. The big problem they had back then were periodic debt crises. The administrative and merchant classes would be constantly lending money to farmers and shepherds and so forth. And then if there was a bad season, people would get in debt. They'd come and start taking stuff away. And, you know, first they'd come for your flocks or your fields, but after a while they'd come for your family. And it was possible to take people's sons and daughters off, employ them as servants. But increasingly they would find them employed in these sort of red light zones that surrounded the big temples. So when we talk about Babylon as a sort of place of big money and the place of sin and prostitutes, which is this imagery that appears over and over again in the Bible all the way through the Old Testament to the Book of Revelations to Rastafari today, all of that imagery seems to go back to this. This terrible fear that people had of having your daughters taken away for unpaid debts and turned into prostitutes around the temples, which did happen a lot. And one result was that people would flee. Generally speaking, in much of the ancient world, rather than rise up, the most common expedient was just to run off. You'd run off to the outskirts of the city. There would be these sort of semi-nomadic pastoralists, and you'd join up with them. And occasionally those people would just sort of counterattack and overflow the city and take over again. But those people were the kind of people who were very patriarchal, and they became even more so. So there was a kind of dynamic where people would join up with these people who sort of lived like the biblical patriarchs, started locking away their wives and daughters. And gradually this kind of classic biblical patriarchy took hold.
And it involved, as you write, a kind of rejection of urban life, right? These people were escaping, were leaving the city, and were becoming part of a patriarchal society which had, what, a certain kind of contempt for commoditized life?
They did, yes. And one of the things about this whole honor complex you see over and over again is it combines this obsession with chastity of women folk and this contempt for commerce. You know, an honorable person, someone who doesn't really care, who gives it all away, who just like blows it all in a big party for his friends because he doesn't care about money. So there's a link between these things, which otherwise seems kind of mysterious. One reason I started on this path of trying to understand what happened was I was talking to my ex-girlfriend at the time, actually, also an anthropologist, about honor killings. And there was a study of knife fights on some Greek island. Somebody went through police reports in the 1800s, and they found out that like 97% of all the knife fights began when someone accused the other person's mother or sister of being a prostitute, which probably just means that's the thing you say right before you draw your knife. Mm. But nonetheless, I mean, she's made the cogent point of, like, the question I always ask myself is, like, well, who cares? I mean, why does it bother you so much? You know, it's perfectly easy to see a society where if someone suggested your sister was a prostitute, people would find that kind of funny, you know? In fact, such places exist. I'm sure in Madagascar, you know, some of the people I knew, if I'd suggested that, they would say, yeah, I wouldn't put it past her, you know? You know, it's not a big deal necessarily. Who cares? It's taking, you know, exchanging sex for money. Yet, why does it, in some societies, it drives people to a homicidal rage to even suggest it? What's going on there?
Well, what you're saying is what's going on there is sensitivity toward the protection of women under one's care, right, in older societies.
Right, because one's honor is, again, one's honor exists only in relation to the possibility of its being taken away.
What about ancient Greece? So you have a time when money was around, but it was not used to buy anything. Important men pursued honor. Okay. And then later, as you write, around 600 BC, coins and money came into common use in everyday transactions. Commercial markets began to take shape. You write that there was a series of debt crises, there was resistance, there was political unrest. What did the authorities do to forestall such crises, to address them?
Well, that's interesting, because it was quite different than what they did in the Middle East. In the Middle East, you know, the great fear was social breakdown because everybody would run away, and gradually the nomads might sweep back again. So usually kings would react by, for every new king would come in and declare a clean slate. They would just cancel the debt across the board. And that became, of course, institutionalized in the biblical jubilee. In Greece, they didn't really do that. And one reason I think that we might be talking about a fundamental different period of history once coinage begins, because one of the themes of the book is, you know, coinage and money are not the same thing, that credit money actually is the dominant form for a couple thousand years before you really have widespread use of currency in everyday exchange. And that widespread use of currency, when people are actually using coins, what happens simultaneously almost in China, in India, and in Greece, and always in the same context, it has to do with paying soldiers. Soldiers being the people most likely to have little looted pieces of gold and silver anyway, and the last people you want to extend credit to. Government simply institutionalized the system. And in Greece, which is a very militarized society, it spreads very quickly, so everybody's starting to use coins in the marketplace and everyday transactions. Therefore, you start thinking of money not as a social relation, as you would in a credit economy, but rather as a thing. You know, gold and silver actually are money. So when you have that concept, canceling debts seems a lot more difficult. People don't want to do it. Instead, they kind of throw money at the problem, as it were. So Solon, during one of the early debt crises, and almost all the Greek constitutions begin with some kind of debt crisis. In Athens, Solon's solution was to forbid debt slavery, the extreme abuses, but he never cancels the debts entirely or gets rid of the system. They simply figure out a way to keep money flowing to people. For example, most people don't realize that in ancient Athens, you were paid to go vote.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, if you go attend the Agora, they gave you a little cash. You know, they said, well, you're missing a day of work. But they would give you a lot more than you would actually get for a day of work. You were paid to do jury duty. That's what poor people actually lived off of in Athens for the most part, political participation.
Hmm.
But the same sort of honor system develops in an interesting way. Again, you have this crisis over slavery, prostitution, how to tell the good girls and the bad girls. The veil, for example, is first documented in Assyria, what's now Iraq, around 1500 BC. And interestingly enough, the rule says that respectable women have to wear veils, and slaves and prostitutes are not allowed to wear veils. But there's no penalties if you're a respectable woman who doesn't. There's only penalties if you're a bad girl who does. In ancient Athens, women had to wear veils too. This sort of so flies against our image of what Athens is supposed to be like and what Arabs are supposed to be like, because, of course, you know, the Middle East is like the sort of benighted, uncivilized people, and ancient Athens is the beacon of Western civilization. But actually, no. Women in ancient Athens were expected not to go outside except in veils.
David Graeber joins us. He teaches anthropology at Goldsmiths University of London. We'll take a short music break and return with more with David Graeber. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. David Graeber, anthropologist, activist, author, writer, journalist. He's been active in several direct action groups, including the Direct Action Network, People's Global Action, and Anti-Capitalist Convergence. His book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years, is now out in paperback. We have a link to that book and to information about David on our website, againstthegrain.org. All right, so a lot of people listening to our discussion might be thinking, well, this is ancient history. This is old stuff. These are developments in the past, and we've moved far beyond them, right? I mean, we now, for a long time, have had money being used to pay for the necessities of life. And, I mean, honor still exists, of course, but in most societies we know of, conceptions of honor have changed dramatically. What is your response to that? And what, from what we've talked about so far, what can we learn that might be applied to today?
Well, there's all sorts of things. I mean, if you want to imagine that we're now living in a sort of rational economic world, we can go from Greece then to Greece now, right? I mean, what is rational about what's happening in Greece right now? It's all about morality and honor, and, you know, sort of punishing people who are seen to be remiss and not giving in on moral points, despite the fact that people are dying in the streets at this point. So really, less has changed than we'd like to think. But there's much broader lessons, I think, in the book. The most hopeful one has to do with just that kind of alternation between systems dominated by credit money, like you see in the ancient Middle East and really across Eurasia in the earliest period. And then you have this period where they introduce cash for the first time for about 1,000 years. You have a period of standing armies, empires, slavery, extraordinarily violent, also extraordinarily culturally creative, philosophically creative. But, you know, then the Middle Ages, it reverts back to credit systems. Everybody always likes to say it reverted to barter, but it didn't. It reverted to credit. And then, really, it's only around 1500 of the invasion of the Americas that you go back to a system dominated by gold and silver bullion. Big empires reappear, slavery reappears. I would say that period is only beginning to end now. And incidentally, from my particular perspective, I don't really see a big difference between chattel slavery and wage slavery in the broad sweep of history. I think that we've only really started moving away from that system of bullion-based currency since 1971, when Nixon went off the gold standard. You have a whole series of things that happen in rapid succession after that, like, you know, the cashless economy, the financialization of capitalism, and also a series of endless credit and debt crises that have been happening ever since. It strikes me that one of the major lessons we have to learn from history is that people have faced these problems before. It's not totally unprecedented. First of all, a credit economy is not something new. We like to imagine it's just made possible by computers and no one ever had something like that before. It's not true at all. The original money economies were credit economies. People would use silver or other things like that occasionally for big transactions, or most transactions were on credit. And that's been the rule throughout human history. However, when that's the dominant form, you need to set up some sort of mechanism to make sure the system doesn't go crazy and everybody doesn't basically end up getting enslaved to 1 or 2% of the population who have the means to create credit. That's why you had debt cancellations through much of Middle Eastern history. That's why in the Middle Ages they had anti-usury laws, and they had other things they did in other places. So there has to be some kind of big mechanism they set up to protect debtors from creditors, to make sure the whole thing doesn't go crazy. Well, you know, here we have the last 30, 40 years, we've been moving back to a system like that. And of course, that's not very long. I mean, we're talking about 500 to 1,000-year cycles of history. 30 years is nothing. But it seems perfectly clear that we've done it completely backwards. Now, what do? They set up things like the IMF and Standard & Poor's, and basically institutions which seem to be designed to protect creditors from debtors rather than the other way around. Well, you know, what happens? Exactly the kind of debt crisis that everybody in ancient Greece or ancient Mesopotamia or ancient China, for that matter, was most terrified of. When those guys thought of social breakdown, the worst thing that could possibly happen, what did they imagine? They imagined a situation where everyone is so deeply in debt, or huge portions of the population are so deeply in debt that they are forced to sell their children or sell themselves into slavery, and a total social breakdown ensues. Well, you know, I think if Aristotle were alive today, as I always say, you know, he would find the distinction between somebody who's so deeply in debt that he sells himself to work for others and some guy who's so deeply in debt that he rents himself to work for others as something of a legalistic distinction. They would say that that crisis is exactly what's happening to most people in the world right now.
Mm. Another set of issues you bring up and address in this book, debt, and they certainly relate to what you've been talking about, are rights and freedom and liberty. And I wonder if we could go back to Roman law, which many people know is the foundation of many of our modern legal concepts and standards. And you investigate in this book how Roman law defined property and private property. Tell us about those definitions.
Yeah, it's a fascinating. The whole idea of private property has always seemed so strange to me since, you know, it doesn't really exist. I mean, very few of the things you see around you are actually owned by an individual. You know, most of our economy is dominated by corporations, which are collectives. The whole notion of private property is riddled with contradictions, even philosophically, which when they tried to revive Roman law and set up modern legal systems in the early Middle Ages, people were very quick to point this out. Because unlike almost all other legal traditions in the world, which recognize that property is simply a system of arrangements that people have with other people about who has access to things and under what circumstances, Roman law defines property as power. They define property as a relationship between a person and a thing characterized by the total power of the person over the thing. This is weird in any number of different ways, but first and foremost, how do you have a relationship with a thing? Well, you can have a relationship with a thing, but why would that have anything to do with property? The example that's always given is the desert island. You know, here I am on a desert island, there's a tree. I'm sure I have a deeply personal relationship with a tree. For all I know, I spend half my time talking to it. But does that mean I have property rights over it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the property rights only come up if somebody else is on the island. This demonstrates, of course, what property really is, its relationship between people. So why do they want to say this at all, and why do they talk about it as total power? You know, your property rights over your, you know, your automatic weapon consists of your right to do anything you want with the automatic weapon. Well, not really, no. So then they like say, well, it's your right to do anything you want other than that which you're either forbidden to do or physically can't by force or law, which, you know, is a little bit like saying, well, the sun is blue, except insofar as it's yellow. I mean, since like almost anything you would do with this thing is regulated in any number of different ways.
So what accounts for this Roman emphasis on the owner having absolute power to do anything he wants with his property subject to certain limitations?
Well, historians have looked into this, and what they find is that this strange definition of property is not the original one in Roman law. It emerges at a very specific period of history, and it emerges at exactly the point where millions of slaves are flowing into the Roman Empire. Essentially, it's becoming a slave society, so that most, you know, even middle-class Roman families have slaves in them who are a conquered population. You know, they're seen as slaves came from various ways, but they're all seen as people conquered by Roman arms that we could have killed, and they're prisoners of war who we forgave, and therefore we have total power over them. And if you think about the relationship between an owner and a slave in Roman society, well, you know, it is a relationship between two people of total power, whereby that person becomes a thing. In fact, slaves are things legally, and they're slaves because they're totally in the power of another person. So when they were thinking of property, a slave was their primary example, and it does make sense, you know, in that context. However, it has really, really weird and lasting implications on how people think about everything else. In almost all human societies, you know, there's a certain notion of freedom, for example, which usually means not being a slave. It's an interesting point that Moses Finley, the great classicist, made that, you know, doctrines of political freedom, you know, the most famous doctrines of political freedom tend to come out of places with extreme forms of slavery, like ancient Athens or colonial Virginia. Because, you know, it's easy to see the contrast. If you can see absolute unfreedom, you could imagine absolute freedom. Most societies think everybody's kind of in between. But the Roman the notion of freedom changes. Originally, it means the right to be part of a community, and that's usually what freedom means. Freedom means the ability to form social relations. The word free in English is actually derived etymologically from the same root as the word friend. Mm-hmm. Originally, to be free means to be able to have friends, because if you're a slave, you can't have friends, because you can't make promises or commitments to others. Your only social relation is with your owner, who has total power over you. So it's the same in early Roman law. That's why if you are a slave and they grant you your liberty, you automatically become a Roman citizen, because freedom is meaningless except as being part of a community. Now, however, it gradually changes to being something much more like this strange definition of property. Now, that absolute power that an owner has over their slave, and therefore by extension a owner of property has over all the other things they have as well, becomes the template from which they imagine freedom. So that freedom is the ability to do anything, the power to do anything you want, other than those things you either can't do because they're impossible or because you're not allowed. Again, it's really strangely contradictory because, as medieval jurists immediately pointed out, well, it doesn't mean the slaves are free, because slaves can do anything they want other than those things they can't do. It's just that what they can't do is almost anything. It doesn't make any logical sense, but it flows from that idea that your power and over your chattels, of which the primary ones are your slaves, is the paradigm for freedom. So rather than freedom just being not a slave and therefore being able to have relations with others, you know, freedom becomes modeled on the relation you have with those whose freedom you totally negate.
And I take it your point is that this notion of freedom as the right to do what one likes with one's own property has had great longevity, hasn't it?
Indeed. And it's become, very disturbingly, the basis for our entire conception of rights. And there's great literature on this. One of the first people to point it out was C.B. McPherson, who pointed out that what he called it the political theory of possessive individualism, that essentially almost all of our rights are negative rights rather than positive rights, or the ones that people take seriously. You know, if you read the UN Charter of Human Rights, almost any Charter of Human Rights, they'll say, you know, everybody has the right to employment, everybody has the right to basic foodstuffs. But you'll never hear somebody accusing, you know, some country of violating human rights for removing price supports on rice, you know, or not engaging in full employment policies. You know, we never think of those as rights. Whenever we think of rights, we think of something negative, like locking people up, killing them, torturing them. Why is that? McPherson pointed out this because that model of freedom and property are so deep in our mind that ultimately what we see as our rights are our ability to own ourselves. So it's a very strange thing in a way, because ownership, of course, is originally thought of in terms of slavery, but now we have private property over our own persons. And this is actually, you know, how it was expressed originally in the 16th century, 17th century, mainly 17th, in England, when they were first mapping these things out. They were quite explicit. I have, you know, every man is the owner of his own house, his own body, his own chattels, and so forth, and nobody can trespass on any of them. So we take this property model and we apply it to everything, to the point where even in our common sense, our rights are simply our ownership rights over ourselves, and that ownership itself is modeled on slavery.
I'm speaking with David Graeber. He teaches anthropology at University of London. So, David, what do we do with the fact that this framework of thinking about liberty and thinking about rights is rooted in notions that derive in large part from slavery?
I think we need to first become conscious of it so we can start thinking. I mean, there are other traditions even in, you know, in the ways that we talk about these things. But first of all, we have to see where a lot of these ideas are coming from and get back. You know, I like that idea that freedom is the ability to make friends. What if we were to start from that? And this is why I say a debt is a corruption of a promise. One reason I thought it was so important to think about the idea of debt is that we can't think about promises and obligations as morality anymore in a clear-headed way, because we've come to think of debt as the great metaphor for what a promise or what a moral obligation is, rather than a weird perversion of a moral obligation. So maybe freedom is the ability to make promises, real promises between free people, to decide who you want to make commitments to and who you don't, and when circumstances change to mutually renegotiate those commitments.
We're coming to the end of our time. I do want to ask you about slavery and its impact on how people think about human beings. So you stress in your writings that slavery has a kind of unique ability to tear human beings from their contexts, from their social context, from their relationships with other people, and to turn them into abstractions. Could you elaborate on that and maybe relate that to the rise of money and commodities and how those two trends converge?
Yeah, it's actually really important because if you're thinking about social economies, social currencies, if you're thinking about situations where people are using currency largely to rearrange relations with each other, rather than a way to completely repay a debt, money is a way of recognizing that there's a debt that you're never going to be able to repay, especially if it's something like someone killed your brother. You know, obviously I'm not going to be able to pay this debt, but I recognize just how much I can't by giving, you know, 25 heifers, because that's what it says, and so forth and so on. Now, the question is how you get from there to the point where you actually do cancel out a debt so that a person can be used as a measure of value equivalent to other things. And the example of the Irish slave girls as currency is a perfect example of that. How did slave girls become the ultimate currency? It's exactly through those forms of degradation. What you're doing when you rip someone out of their home to make them a washerwoman in someone else's house is precisely destroying all their social ties. So the only way you can take a person and turn them into a unit of currency is to essentially say, all those thousands of different relationships, the fact that she's somebody's sister, that she's somebody's true love, that she's somebody's best friend, that she's somebody's playmate, dearly remembered, you know, that's irrelevant. Who cares about that? The only thing that matters is relationship with the person who's now your boss. That can only be done through violence. But since it's all about human relations originally, those are the kind of moves that set up the forms of alienation that make a structure of markets possible. That's one of the sort of secret embarrassments of market economies, is that they start with slave markets above all. They start with war, loot, theft, and slavery. Another point I make at the end of the book is that, you know, if you think about objects, you know, most societies, any important objects are the same. They're histories. They embody histories of social relations. There's this famous story you always hear about the ethnographer, you know, traveling through some part of Africa, usually it's Zululand. I've actually heard three different versions of this story, with some informant who's like, they're doing some survey and they're going past thousands of cows every day, herds of cows, herds of cows, herds of cows. That's all you ever see. And after 3 days, the informant looks up and says, oh, look at that. That's the same cow. We saw that cow 3 days ago somewhere else. You know, every cow is an individual. They're like faces. You just recognize them. And, of course, if the cows moved them and somebody got married or something happened. And so objects, too, you know, they have histories. They're embedded in social life. To make them something completely alienable, you have to rip them out of all that. How does that usually happen? Well, usually in war or theft. You know, who is the first guy who looked at a room full of objects and said, you know, what will I get for that? What will I get for that? Where can I, you know, surely he must have been a burglar. So market logic, that idea that things can be fully detached from their histories, from all the people who care about them, which is what makes them what they are and gives them value, and have a value simply in terms of their potential use, is something that can only really happen in a context of violence.
But on the issue of the abstraction of human beings, could you imagine markets in which things like carrots and airplanes and hammers, they are monetarized, right? They are given a specific value, but humans retain their unique complexity and they are not reduced to a number.
Well, it can be done, but I think it would have to be done by keeping the numerization of everything to a minimum. I mean, the way I talk about money, you know, when I think about what a free society would be like, I say, well, you know, we have to remember that money is a rationing device, you know. Say it's wartime, they're rationing butter, they're rationing milk, so you get a little coupon for each, right? Well, you know, money is just a coupon that can get you anything. However, it seems only reasonable to say that in a free society, we would like to ration as little as possible. Rationing is not a good thing. Obviously, it would be hard to imagine a society where you never ration anything. But I think that the more you have a pervasive logic whereby it just seems natural that everything has a price, the more impossible it is to keep that away from people. However, and this is another element I think is very important, that system does ultimately have to be kept in place by violence. And one of the things that fascinated me about the looking over the history that I didn't really expect is that when systems, like state systems of enforcement, break down and their markets remain, the markets change. Suddenly they become all about honor. Suddenly one's own personal integrity, for example, is actually considered a form of capital in itself, which makes sense because, you know, if you rip people off and there's like nobody to enforce the contracts, nobody's going to deal with you anymore. You have to have a certain level of trust. Interestingly enough, the whole ideal of the free market comes out of those contexts where the market is essentially separated from coercive state enforcement, so people have to come to deals with each other, whereupon it's not seen as inherently competitive. You know, it's a completely different world. This is really the world of medieval Islam that I talk about in chapter 10. It's sort of another issue, but the point is that you can have market-like phenomena without the violence, but they'll quickly start transforming into something else. And I think if you completely eliminated the violence, they would quickly turn into something which we wouldn't recognize at all.
David Graeber, anthropologist, activist. He teaches at the University of London, and his books include Possibilities, Essays on Hierarchy, Rebellion, and Desire, Lost People, and Toward an Anthropological Theory of Value. We've been talking about his latest book, Debt, The First 5,000 Years. David, thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio and sign up for our podcast. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670, and check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. That's Against the Grain Radio on Facebook.